in the station. Good afternoon, everyone. We are a bit late getting started, and I hate that. I don't know who to blame it on but myself today, so I'm sorry about that. We were busy. Anyway, we have a serious problem, however, because I do not see Representative Johnson anywhere. This is a problem. We'll have to forego. We'll have to delay the approval of the minutes of the last meeting until the suspect arrives. We have a presentation first off today from the Office of the Legislative Auditor. It's my preference that we allow them to go straight through their presentation and then save our questions till afterwards. But if you've got something really hot and burning that you just can't wait to ask, I suppose we could try to squeeze it in, but it'll be a little black mark on your record. So, welcome to the Office of the Legislative Auditor. Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is David Kirshner, and I work for the Office of the Legislative Auditor. I am here to present to you an evaluation report that we completed last year and presented to the Joint Committee of the House and the Senate last year, and we're back again at your invitation, so thank you very much for having us. I'd like to acknowledge the work of the other two people that worked on this project, Ryan Moltz, who is not here because he's busy meeting with other legislators at the moment, and Catherine Tyson, who's over here in the audience, but their hard work is certainly reflected in the presentation I'm going to make. We're asked to do a broad look at how MnDOT selects the projects that it builds. And let me give you kind of a quick overview of where we're headed. Our kind of key findings in this report was that MnDOT does not have just one project selection process. It has several different project selection processes. The standard process, how most of the projects are selected, we found those projects were selected pretty much consistently with MnDOT's stated priorities for what it's trying to do. But we found that process was not as transparent as we thought it should be. And MnDOT also has a number of alternate processes. Those different processes produced projects that were not always as consistent with MnDOT's stated priorities of where it was going. We particularly felt that there was a bit of an overemphasis on choosing projects that could start construction quickly. And we had some particular concerns with the Corridors of Commerce program. So with that overview out of the way, let me start with just a little bit of background. You can think of the framework of putting a project together as involving a kind of a planning phase where there are broad goals, broad statements about the entire program, and then a particular piece where MnDOT selects specific projects to build, and then the actual construction. And we really looked at that middle box up on the chart there, at how MnDOT selects projects. Construction projects are projects that replace or rehabilitate or sometimes build new elements of trunk highways. There are preservation projects and expansion projects. A preservation project is a project that builds where the infrastructure that you have at the end of the project is the same as the infrastructure you had at the start. So even if it's a major rebuilding of a bridge, if you have the same number of lanes going over the river at the end that you had at the beginning, it's still a preservation project. An expansion project is a project where new infrastructure is there at the end of the project that wasn't there before. And just to note, we did not look a whole lot at preventive maintenance projects. Those come out, as you know, of a different budget line and a different process altogether. So we primarily looked at projects coming out of the state road construction budget. There are not that many state requirements in law, legal requirements, about how MnDOT should choose the projects that it's going to build. There are some broad goals in law, but for the most part, the legislature has given MnDOT discretion to choose projects as it will. There are a few requirements in federal law. The MAP 21 legislation that was passed by Congress in 2012 told states to focus most specifically on the national highway system. That's a subset of MnDOT's trunk highway system, or rather the state trunk highway system. MnDOT builds it works on it for the state. And we have a map of that system on page 4. And you'll see from that map that the national highway system roads are the interstates, the major intercity connector highways, and it's not all of MnDOT, of the trunk highway system. The federal government can sanction states that don't keep those national highway system roads up to par. The FAST Act that was passed in 2015, right around the time our report was released, continued those same priorities, but also put some more emphasis on the efficient movement of freight. MnDOT's standard project selection process, I'll start with that first, that is just now actually kind of coming into view, in that they've had this process for a while, but because it takes MnDOT a long time to plan projects before they're built, actually the first projects being built under this process are being built this year for the first time, even though they've been planning this way since 2013. In this process, districts choose projects, but they are constrained by requirements of the central office. The central office sets performance targets and sets spending guidelines, and the district choices have to all together fit within those performance targets and the spending guidelines. I'm not going to talk a whole lot about the performance targets, but we do have a list of those in the report on page 19, I believe it is. But I will very briefly touch on the spending targets. These targets that are on the slide are not in the report because these are the brand new targets. The MnDOT has just released its new 20-year state highway plan, and so these were the new spending targets that were in that plan as of last month. As you can see, MnDOT intends to spend the vast majority of the money available to it on preservation projects, on maintaining and keeping in good shape the roads that it already has. There are a few pieces of expansion projects in here. They're hidden in those smaller single-digit numbers down at the bottom, but for the vast majority of what MnDOT is planning to do is to preserve and maintain existing infrastructure. I'm not going to go through the standard process in detail. It would take me a long time, but we do have a kind of detailed outline of how that works in Chapter 2 of the report. But just to give you some broad features of it, MnDOT does, we found that MnDOT does direct its funds to its stated priorities. It says it's going to do primarily preservation, and that is what the standard process does, is it directs money primarily to preservation projects. Pavement and bridge preservation projects pretty much drive everything else. So those are the projects that are selected first, and then everything else is fit in around them. So if you're talking about, for example, a pedestrian piece of infrastructure or a bicycle thing or culverts, those don't get chosen by themselves. First, what happens is the big bridge and pavement projects get decided upon, and then MnDOT decides what little pieces it might add on to those to provide additional bang for the buck. Another point to make is that MnDOT districts are pretty much making the key choices here about individual projects. The central office does not do a whole lot of oversight of individual project choices by the districts. Instead, it looks at their overall package, and it says, when taken all together, how do these projects do a good job of meeting the performance targets and meeting the spending guidelines that we've given you? And if all together they meet those criteria, then they've done a good job. But so the central office does not do a whole lot of careful looking at individual projects. We had some concerns when we came to you last year about the transparency of this project selection process. We found that the projects were often chosen internally, a lot of conversations between planners and engineers within MnDOT district offices, and there was not a whole lot of direct involvement in that programming process by local stakeholders. We felt that MnDOT could be providing better information about how it was making the choices it was making. In particular, we thought that MnDOT could do a better job talking a little bit more about what it decided not to do so that stakeholders could have some sense, and by stakeholders I'm talking about city governments, county governments, members of the public, anybody who might be interested in the state's roads. We felt the stakeholders would have a better sense of what was being decided and how it was being decided if they had some basis for comparison. If there are these three projects that MnDOT has chosen, that doesn't tell us as much about how MnDOT made its choices than if we can see those three projects and we can see four other projects that weren't chosen. And we can look at the criteria for each one of those projects and we can say, oh, based on these criteria that MnDOT uses, all of these projects met those criteria, and these other four projects that some other people might like to see done, they didn't meet those criteria and rise as high. So we made a broad recommendation for MnDOT to improve its transparency in the standard decision-making process.
Excuse me, Mr. Kirchner.
Yes.
I knew I said I wasn't going to interrupt you, but our tardy member has finally arrived, and it's important that we approve the minutes. I'll try not to chastise you any further, Representative Johnson. Do you have a motion tonight?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are a lot of farmers from my neck of the woods in town today, and I was tied up with them, and
clearly
so. But anyway, I do move the minutes from February 2nd.
Thank you. Representative Johnson moves approval of the minutes from February 2nd. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed by the same sign. Thank you, Representative. I accept your apology since you were meeting on behalf of the farmers. Keep that up. Mr. Kirchner, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Please go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You picked a great time, actually, because I was just about to pivot from the standard process to the alternative process, so it was a nice place to take a break. As I was saying, thank you, Representative Johnson, for helping me get that pause there. MnDOT, as I said, has a number of alternative processes for how it selects projects. And there are a number of these. There are a number of what we call specialty programs within MnDOT. These include Corridors of Commerce, the Transportation Economic Development Program, a couple of other programs that we outline in the report. There are also instances where MnDOT leadership selects projects directly. I'll talk about that in a minute. We looked not just at MnDOT, but we considered our scope to be projects built on trunk highways. And when looked at that way, we also know that there are a number of projects that take place on trunk highways that are decided upon and led by local units of government. And we looked at those as well. And then there are occasionally instances where lawmakers choose projects. We no longer have quite as many instances of congressional earmarking as we once had, but there have been instances where the legislature has directed that certain projects be done, particularly in bonding bills, not so much in the transportation funding bills most recently. So some broad features of all these alternative processes when looked at together, there's much less money in these processes than in the standard process. In page 54 of the report, we have a listing of a number of those types of processes and the amount of money that was put toward them over a six-year period. And those of you that are familiar with the state road construction budget, we'll look at those numbers and say that's a lot less money than we spent over 6 years on state road construction. So the numbers there are smaller. These projects are not decided usually at the district level. They're instead decided at the central office level or, in the case of locally led projects, not outside of MnDOT altogether. There's often a competitive application process when districts, or MnDOT districts, or sometimes local units of government compete against each other. And there are many of these projects prioritize what can be started quickly. That is part of the criteria for a lot of these alternative selection processes. Each process has its own selection criteria. And generally speaking, almost all these processes are designed in one way or another to circumvent MnDOT's standard priorities. The processes were often created because certain types of projects were not getting done in the way that MnDOT normally brought its projects forward, and so these processes were created to try and bring other projects forward. But that does circumvent the state of priority toward preservation. As I advertised earlier, we had some particular concerns with the Corridors of Commerce program. This is a program that was passed by the legislature in 2013 to fund expansion projects in a couple of different circumstances, particularly where there were gaps in the trunk highway system. For example, where a highway is four lanes and then goes down to two lanes and then back up to four lanes again, the expansion project could make that four lane all the way through. Or perhaps to create a better connection between two trunk highways for which there's not a good one highway to the other connection. The law also enabled MnDOT to put some effort toward efficient movement of freight. The law required that MnDOT take public suggestions for projects that could be funded through Corridors of Commerce, and the law listed specific criteria that it wanted MnDOT to use to evaluate those projects. The amount of funding the legislature has put toward Corridors of Commerce has fluctuated quite a lot. The first year the program was put in place, there was $300 million of bonding money put toward it. The next year, there was $6.5 million. The year after that, $25 million. So it has moved around quite a bit. As I said, we had some concerns with the selection process for Corridors of Commerce. We found that MnDOT, although it accepted public suggestions, it didn't actually evaluate those suggestions unless they happened to correspond with suggestions that were made internally within MnDOT. If a suggestion came in from the public that was not also made from within MnDOT, it was basically just discarded and not looked at. MnDOT used some, but not all, of the criteria that were listed in the law for, that it was supposed to use for selecting these projects, and MnDOT added a number of its own criteria that were not in the law. Even after choosing its own criteria in this way, we found that MnDOT did not actually consistently choose the projects that its own evaluation had scored the highest. And we found, at least in one instance, that MnDOT leadership had inserted a project very, very late in the process. In fact, at the final meeting where the recommendations were being made to the commissioner, a brand new project was brought forward by leadership and put into the program. So we have some recommendations for MnDOT and for the legislature with regard to corridors of commerce that we made last year. We recommended that MnDOT align its selection process and criteria better with the law. And we suggested that the legislature should require that MnDOT report a detailed description of its criteria, what they were and how they were measured, and that it release a public list of it, all of the projects that were suggested and how it had scored on that criteria and how they were ranked against each other. Moving on to a couple of other of the types of alternative processes that I talked about, there are some instances where MnDOT leadership chooses projects directly. I want to highlight here the work of a committee called TPIC, the Transportation Programming Investment Committee. It's a very senior committee within MnDOT, consisting of the deputy commissioners, the division directors, and the Metro District Engineer. That committee technically recommends all of the projects I've been talking about to the commissioner. That is, all the projects that come through the standard process, all the projects that come through the various alternative processes, they eventually come to TPIC for approval and recommendation to the commissioner. But TPIC also serves as something of a clearinghouse for unexpected problems or unplanned funds. When something comes forward that MnDOT had not been planning on, it's TPIC that has to figure out, okay, where are we going to find the money for that? One example of that would be the large construction project to move a portion of Highway 53 to go around a planned mine on the Iron Range. That was something that was not in MnDOT's long-range plans, and so when that came up, TPIC had to come up with some ideas about how to work on putting together funding for that program. There are sometimes instances where money comes forward as well that has not been planned. There are instances where MnDOT receives federal funds, but it does not know shortly before the funds arrive how much money it's getting, and so it's hard to plan for that. And, for example, in 2015, the legislature appropriated an additional $134 million to MnDOT for state road construction purposes, and it was TPIC that decided where that money was going to go. As I said previously, there are instances where local units of government lead projects on MnDOT roads. Often these are interchange projects between county roads and or city roads and MnDOT trunk highways, but there are other types of projects as well. These are generally the local units of government generally assemble funding from a variety of sources, local, state, and federal. MnDOT may contribute funding to these projects, but does not always. Of course, there has to be MnDOT approval if it involves a trunk highway. And we wanted to be able to provide in our report a listing of these projects and how much money was spent on these projects. And we were surprised that MnDOT was not able to provide us with that information in any sort of systematic fashion. In order for us to be able to provide you with that information, we would have had to go to every single local unit of government and ask them about the amount of money that they had spent. We thought that MnDOT should be tracking this amount of money that's being spent and this work that's being done and reporting that to the legislature so that you have a comprehensive picture of what happens on MnDOT's trunk highways and not just the picture of what MnDOT itself is doing. So we made a recommendation that MnDOT start tracking that information and reporting on it to the legislature. Overall, with regard to the alternative processes, when taken as a whole, we had some concerns. We felt that there was a bit too much of an emphasis on project readiness, on how quickly projects could start construction, and we felt that that sometimes disadvantaged projects that were of considerable interest to local stakeholders. One example would be in many outstate cities in Minnesota, the main roads that run through those cities are, in fact, Minnesota trunk highways, and MnDOT is responsible for maintaining and upgrading those. Those those cities are often very, very interested in rehabilitation and reconstruction projects on those roads because it will allow those cities to more easily get at the water and sewer infrastructure that runs underneath. So those are projects of particular interest to local stakeholders, and yet when you have processes that emphasize stuff that can start quickly, those types of projects are disadvantaged because it takes a lot of time to do the coordination that's needed for that amount of construction work across multiple different types of utilities and roads. Also, we noted that projects that are started very quickly often end up costing more, and that's because MnDOT districts have already planned what their staff are going to be doing. And so when new projects come forward out of these alternative processes, they often end up hiring consultants or other additional staff in order to be able to get those projects done. We found that these different alternative processes, there was basically a new selection process created for each one of them, that MnDOT did not have an overall set of priorities for how it was going to be able to make use of these various types of new money that would come forward for expansion or other types of projects. So we had some, I'll conclude with the two kind of broad recommendations we made about the alternative processes. First of all, we suggested that both the legislature and the way that it writes laws and MnDOT de-emphasize a bit project readiness as a key criterion. We felt that there may be instances where it would be valuable to pay attention to how quickly something can start. If, for example, you're looking at an economic development-oriented project where it's oriented toward a particular business's trucking needs, for example, there might be a reason to emphasize a project that can start quickly. But in many of the cases we saw, we didn't see that. It just was what can get started right away. And the second thing is that we felt MnDOT should develop a transparent long-term planning and prioritization process for these expansion projects that are funded through alternative processes and not simply keep reinventing new processes and new sets of criteria each time some additional funding came in and a new program could get generated. And with that, Mr. Chair, that's the conclusion of my prepared report, and I'd be happy to take any questions from members.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Kirchner. You know, my mother was an English teacher, but that particular gene set didn't get through the process, and so I'm somewhat deficient. So if you go back a couple slides.
Yes.
One more forward. There, the term criterion. It's not in my vocabulary.
As far as I know, it's one criterion, two criteria. It's the singular version of criterion.
So criterion is the singular and criteria is the plural?
I hope I'm right, because I'd be very embarrassed if I'm wrong.
I see Clark. Clark is nodding his head, and he's like a upper-level educator, so we will trust his judgment, even though he didn't speak, that is correct. Well, see, now I try to learn something every day, and you've helped me, so I appreciate it. Yeah. All right, we have a question, a real question from Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had asked, thank you for doing this audit. I think it's very helpful. Takes the mystery out of it a little bit and gets a better understanding for the public to know what's happening and how we can improve it. One of the things that you touched on last time that you presented to this committee, we have some new members now, is when MnDOT receives federal funding and they're required to do environmental justice on their project from project selection all the way through to maintenance, the part of their whole program. So when you went in and you dug deeper on this, how does MnDOT incorporate environmental justice on their project selection?
Mr. Kirchner.
Thank you very much for the question, Representative Bernardi. We always have to kind of pick and choose what we put in the presentation, and so I'm always happy to talk about other things that were in the report that I didn't manage to get in, so thank you very much for the question. We did talk about that in the report. That discussion is on pages 50 and 51 of the report. So under federal rules, MnDOT is required to follow a bunch of federal guidelines of a variety of things, and these involve the Americans with Disabilities Act, the Older Americans Act, Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and so forth, in everything that it does. The requirements are very broad, It's not, there's not a specific, you should be doing this, 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 and this, but it is supposed to be paying attention to these things. And there's actually a statement in the front of the four-year plan that it presents to the government every year that says we have looked at these things in terms of how we're doing our work. And so when we went out and visited with engineers, district engineers in MnDOT districts, we would ask them, so how, in your project selection process, how do you pay attention to these things? And the answer that we generally got was, well, we don't. Those are things that we look at after the projects have been selected. Once a project has been selected, then we start thinking about, all right, do we need to pay particular attention to people with disabilities or particular attention to communities of poverty in the area or so forth. But it's not part of how we select the projects in the first place. We did not make a recommendation on that, in part because the federal requirements are so broad, but we did direct MnDOT's attention to the fact that this just didn't seem to be part of the process at all. And I believe, in a preview of what MnDOT will say when they're coming up, I believe that's one of the things that they have been working on in response to our report.
Thank you.
Next, I have Representative Salk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you talked about having presentations to the public forum kind of thing, what comes to my mind is also that there's a point at which transparency in that form can also be a foundation to chaos in terms of planning and or the kinds of things that can evolve out. As you said, three that were in, okay, and I see four that aren't, and as it turns out, the one I'm most emotionally attached to is out, and then it starts this chaotic amount of questioning of the processes and that sort of thing. So as an auditor of that kind of system, how much do you take into account that there is a negative side to the rollout of these completely transparent attempts?
Mr. Kirchner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that is a good point, and that is something that is an extremely important part of the public relations work of any of our state agencies, that our state agencies are frequently making decisions that make people unhappy. That's part of what they do. And it is important for them to be able to explain as clearly as possible why they made the decisions that they did and why they chose not to do some things that some folks wanted. And I think that's true of MnDOT. I think that's true of the Department of Education. I think that's true of any department within state government, that they have to be able – that's part of what I would say what government is all about, is that we try and do things as transparently as possible, and sometimes that's going to make some people unhappy. But we think that transparency is important.
A follow-up for Sam Salk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you then speak a bit about how that should be applied to the legislature itself?
Mr. Kirchner.
Which would be an ultimate expression of the transparency.
I think, goodness. That's a broad question. I certainly think that one of the things that we have suggested here is that the legislature be clear in its expectations of the department, and then the department ought to be clear in how it's meeting those expectations. For example, in the Corridors of Commerce law, there were some clear criteria that the legislature put in place and said, these are the criteria we expect you to use. And then I think it would be transparent for MnDOT, if it's not going to use those criteria, or it's going to use some but not all of them, or it's going to add some extra on, it would be appropriate for MnDOT to come forward and transparently say, well, we feel like we need to add these on because of we think this is important, or because of federal requirements, or because there's something about the way that the money is going to be spent that's important. That to me, is what I – when instead you – I'll give you a counterexample. As I mentioned before, in 2015, the legislature gave MnDOT $134 million or appropriated an additional $134 million out of the Trunk Highway Fund, but then didn't really ask for an accounting of how that money was spent from MnDOT. MnDOT went ahead and spent it on various projects. And that's not to suggest that those were not valuable projects, but MnDOT, the legislature could have also said, oh, and by the way, you know, when you get done with what you're doing, we'd like you to tell us which projects you chose, why those projects were chosen, and what criteria you based that choice on. I think that would be very reasonable for the legislature to do.
Thank you, Mr. Kirchner. I hope that you give the same advice to the governor's office. Next, I have Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Kirchner. I also picked up on a word you used, was that the alternative project selection was used to circumvent standard project selection. From my view, it was not to circumvent. It was really to address needs that were not being met there, and to address, in many ways, regional needs. And where I live, regional corridors and regional centers that needed to be connected, as you ably described. Did you take a look more globally at the challenges of criteria in project selection in a state that has everything from a very well-developed urban core, which faces congestion and those sorts of issues, to selecting projects, and especially in terms of expansion, in the rural areas where we don't have the congestion, but we have safety needs, we have freight needs, we have connecting corridor needs and economic opportunity needs. Did you look at that globally and how to help MnDOT balance or help the legislature understand how we can help balance those different needs in different areas?
Mr. Kirchner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Johnson. I shall say, when I said circumvent, by that I mean that MnDOT's stated priorities were primarily to do preservation work. And so I think it was clearly the case that the legislature wanted some additional expansion work being done, and it would not have been done under MnDOT's kind of standard processes. And so that was, I think, the genesis of some of the quarters. Of the Corridors of Commerce legislation. So in that way, it is, to some extent, a circumvention, is the legislature saying to MnDOT, we want you to do something different than you're doing. And that is the legislature's role and prerogative in doing it. With regard to the differences between the urban core and the outstate areas, I think that part of MnDOT's design for how it does its project selection reflects those different priorities in the district system. I know we have some new members. I assume most folks know the district system, but if you don't, on page 7 of the report is just a map that shows where the different districts are. And each one of those districts is separately making choices about what projects are going to be done. And those districts are going to have very different sets of priorities based upon whether they're in the metropolitan areas or whether they're in rural areas. The projects that were these various alternative process projects, many of them, although not all, but many of them had particular types of criteria in how they were put together that tried to do some of that balancing. For example, the SIMS program, I think it's the Corridor Investment Management Strategy Program, is what that stands for. That was a program where they decided that no more than 60% of the money could go to either the metro area or the outstate, so that, you know, it could be somewhere in between there, 40 to 60, but they wanted to make sure that they didn't choose only projects that were in the metropolitan area or only projects outstate, but tried to get a mix of both. And I think that's often been the case for many of MnDOT's internally generated priorities. It's certainly, I think, the case that for the locally led projects, those majority of those are happening in the metropolitan area. Not all, but most of them are, and that probably is a reflection of which local jurisdictions are able to fund those types of projects.
A follow-up, Representative Johnson.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And then with respect to the idea of public involvement in the planning process, I've attended a number of area transportation planning meetings in District 7, my home district, and I think it's fair to say that my local officials have a very good idea what MnDOT's planning and doing. Did you look at those processes? Are those uniform across the state? If I went to other districts, would I see similar area transportation planning efforts?
Mr. Kirchner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I think you should ask MnDOT, because I think they've looked at those processes since our report. What we found was that it was rather uneven. We spoke with county engineers in districts across the state, and we did a survey of all county engineers, and we found that in some instances they knew an awful lot about what was going on. They said, oh, yeah, I meet with the district engineer on a regular basis. I know exactly what's coming forward. We had other county engineers that said, sometimes I don't find out a project until the signs go up. It really varied from one place to another within the state. And so there were instances where there was good communication. There were other instances where the communication, we thought, could be quite a lot better. And generally speaking, as we said, we felt that MnDOT tended to speak mostly about what it chose to do, and we felt that that comparison between what it chose to do and what it decided to put off for another time or not do at all would provide extra transparency and greater clarity for how MnDOT was making its decisions.
Representative Mason has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At one point, I sat on the Egan City Council, and that's during the time when there was a lot of development, and we were constantly scrambling to get projects done that were necessary. And as a legislator, MnDOT is still way behind in trying to do the projects. And I'm looking at the comment that you made here about it's about limiting their use of project readiness as a criteria. And I'm looking at the booklet a little bit, but I think it would be really helpful, again, to say what that's a pretty strong statement, because normally we'd like to get as many things done as possible.
Yeah.
Mr. Kirchner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Mason. I think our concern there was we found that for many of these alternative processes, that project readiness, that is how quickly a project could start construction, it wasn't just one of the criteria, it was a filter to some extent, so that you had, they would take all the possible projects and they would say, okay, anything that can't be started in the next 2 years, we're not even going to look at. And we said, well, that doesn't necessarily provide the best value for the state of Minnesota to only look at projects that can start construction in the next couple of years. There might be projects, and I gave the example of projects that go through outside cities, that might be very, very valuable to some folks that aren't going to be able to start construction in 2 years. So that was the concern that we raised, is that it's one thing to say, you know, we want to be able to do various types of projects, and you obviously want to be able to sequence out your project so you have something starting sooner and something starting later and something starting later than that. But what we found for a number of these alternative processes was that it was the emphasis on project readiness made it a much stronger criteria than the other criteria that were there, and we felt that wasn't necessarily we couldn't see a reason why that necessarily meant why it was necessarily the case that a project would be better simply because it could start sooner.
I guess President Mason.
Do you have a follow-up?
Just the fact that, the sooner you get a project started, the less money it's going to cost would be the rationale that I would have for trying to look at that.
Yeah. And Mr. Chair?
Mr. Kirchner.
Thank you. I would say that is an excellent criteria. I think cost is a very good criteria. And if it is clearly the case that something is going to cost less because it can start sooner, great. That's a good criteria. Let's use that as a criteria. But that is not always the case, that just because something starts sooner is going to cost less. We have, for example, to take one of the corridors of commerce projects in the report, if you'll look on on page, let's see if I can find it here. On page 57 of the report, we have a listing of all the corridors of commerce projects in 2013. And you'll see that the very top scoring project there, the Armstrong Boulevard interchange project, was not selected. It could have started construction in 2015. And they did select a project way down here near the bottom on Interstate 694. So it's not even, they're both metro projects. They're very similar amounts of money. And it was started a year later. I don't see, to me that there's not, there's... If we were going to talk about cost, let's talk about cost. Those both cost the same. One, they both start within 2 years, but there were other criteria that would have led me to expect when looking at this list that first project on the list would get chosen, and it didn't. So there were other instances where we saw things that were coming forward, and they were coming forward primarily. This one wasn't so much because of project readiness, but there were other instances where stuff was coming forward because it was project readiness, and there were other criteria that meant that may look like other projects maybe ought to come first.
Representative Petersburg has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Kirchner, just out of curiosity, I'm aware of at least four different styles of bidding processes that we do in projects too. I was just curious if you felt that there were any of those bidding processes had any impact on project selection, or were they completely separate?
Mr. Kirchner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't recall that coming up as an issue in terms of the things that were raised when we talked with both MnDOT central office folks and folks at the district level about why certain types of projects were chosen. I don't remember that coming up as an issue.
Representative Hornstein has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Kirshner. I'm glad you called attention to that chart, and we definitely need to work through, that high, low, medium criteria. But just to remind the committee, several of these projects, I've been served on this committee since 2003, and we've heard about Highway 23, and we jump-started that. We've heard about I-94, got that going. 169, Highway 14. Anyone who's been on this committee, we can memorize these projects, and I think that's a good thing. Now we're kind of stuck because we don't have, I believe, additional funding to keep going. But I was intrigued by your slide number 14, since I was thinking about Representative Salk and Representative Johnson's questions and even Representative Mason's just now. You talk about aligning selection process with criteria. I think that's really helpful. Can you be a little more specific? In the statute, as I recall, there are 7 criteria. And are there some that you would prioritize over others? If we were to follow your recommendation, which is a good one, maybe expand a little bit about how you would prioritize the criteria. And do you have advice for us? Because, again, all those 7, I think, are helpful. But would you use all 7? Are there others, some that you would prioritize over others?
Mr. Kirchner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hornstein. The criteria are listed on page 60 of the report, and we show which ones MnDOT used and which ones it didn't. In our best estimation, I think generally going to punt on the question as a whole. There are people at MnDOT who spend their careers working on these sorts of issues and how to plan these things, and the legislature certainly has its own opinions as well. I don't think it's necessarily the role of the auditor to say how MnDOT ought to choose projects. I do think it is our role to say whether or not the process is transparent and whether or not it is meeting certain types of expectations that we have. But I'm not a transportation professional. I'm gonna duck your question, if I may.
Okay, well, I'll call for a fair catch. I don't even know how those guys can catch it with all these people coming after them, but that's here or there.
President Hornstein, I'd like to remind both of you that football season is over. It ended on Sunday night very dramatically, but it's over. Let's
point
move into
taken,
basketball
and hockey. Catchers report in 10 days, I think, or a week. So then I guess I'll ask MnDOT that when they come up. But my second question, and Mr. Chair, I talk about the earmarks. And this was way above both of our pay grades last year, I think. The decision to do some earmark projects in the transportation bill was leadership on both sides, by the way, in the Senate and House. But I'm wondering if you looked at the that bill, and it's not just history. The earmarks are in the Senate bonding bill now, and we don't have one in the House yet, and I hope we won't have the earmarks. But that seems like even exponentially more of a problem than, and I'm not denying there are problems here that have to be fixed, and I hope we can do that, particularly with the Corridors of Commerce program, which I feel strongly about having been part of that legislation, writing that legislation. But it feels to me that what we saw in last year's bill and in this year's Senate bill seems exponentially more problematic in terms of just throwing out any criteria out the window. And I'm wondering if you've looked at that and if you have any thoughts about that.
Well,
Mr. Kirchner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree to a large extent that when legislators or the governor decide to simply choose projects, that is a less transparent process than any of the things that we've been talking about. Our position is to be in favor of transparency, in favor of clear criteria. These are the criteria that are being used, and based upon those criteria, these are the choices that are being made. But as legislators, you have to answer to the voters in a way that will reflect whether or not the voters are happy with the choices that you make.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next, I have Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Kirshner. I want to head back to the district offices again, the engineers, and you're visiting with those engineers. I am I think I'm under the understanding that years ago, maybe 10 years-ish kind of thing, district engineers had more authority and more say about what projects they thought were important, and even to a point where district engineers would actually collaborate with each other and say, hey, look, Highway 14 might be ready in the next year or two for this. I will sort of grant my credit, if you will, to that project for a couple of years, knowing that I'm going to get my favor sort of back or my priorities when we can have our 23 set up to go in a couple more years. Are you seeing any of that going on now in the district, and how much are they communicating and actually sharing that kind of priorities with each other so that they have a larger voice at the central office? So I'm kind of curious about your thought on that.
Mr. Kirchner.
thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Baker. that is, you're absolutely correct. That was the old process. That it was really, districts had tremendous amount of autonomy to make decisions about what they were going to do. And under the new process, there's more constraints put on those projects by the central office. As I said in the presentation, there's still a fair amount of autonomy in terms of districts being able to pick and choose what projects they're going to do, but they have to fit within certain types of constraints. And some of those constraints, frankly, are driven not just by the central office's preferences, but by federal law. And that was why I emphasized the National Highway System at the beginning of the presentation. Federal law says you need to keep those roads up to a certain level of performance. And if they don't meet that certain level of performance, we're going to make you spend money on them in ways that you're not prepared to do until they get to that level of performance. And so after the passage of MAP 21 that put those performance targets or started the process of putting those performance targets into place, that was one of the prompting events that led MnDOT to change its process so that there would be a clearer central office role in thinking about the various things that were being done. Because from the federal point of view, they don't care about District 7 or 8. They care about Minnesota as a whole. What percentage of your interstate highways have appropriately smooth pavement? What percentage of your bridges need reconstruction work? And if all of those bridges happen to be in District 6, they don't penalize District 6. They penalize the state of Minnesota. And so that's part of the reason for that switch over to a more centrally oriented process where there's a look at the statewide priorities as a whole.
Just a quick follow-up, Mr. Baker. Thank you. And I'm also just, my final question would be relating to page 69 on the example you used when the TPIC group used some money for some funding for the St. Croix Bridge project and some unused appropriations from other funds. It made me wonder about if funds are used, let's say, at the quarters of commerce for projects, let's say a bid was granted for $40 million and they only spent $30 million. What happens to that unused money from the quarters of commerce fund? Does the senior management group get to select where that goes? Does it go back in the quarters account? I'm kind of curious what happens to those dollars. Thank you.
Mr. Kirchner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you can turn to the very next page, on page 70, and we have a little shaded box there that gives the story of what happened in that specific instance. There was some extra money left over from quarters of commerce in the first batch of things, and that was a decision made by TPIC, by the Transportation Program Investment Committee, to put that money toward Highway 371, the Nisswada Jenkins expansion to four lane. So that is an instance where that committee basically made the call at that point. There were other projects that it could have used that money on. I would certainly argue that to some extent is another example of not very clear transparency. There wasn't a list of criteria for what would be next in line if there was extra money available, and based upon that criteria, this came to the top. They just basically, a group of people sat in a room and said, well, we think the best use of this money would be for 371. And that may have been the best use of the money, but it's, in the end, it's a bunch of people in a room making a decision, and it's not as transparent a process as we think it could have been.
Thank you, Mr. Kirchner. And members, I have a number of members still on the list. We are nearing the halfway mark in our session, so I would like to try and move through the rest of these questions quickly so we can get to the Transportation Department. So if we keep both the questions and answers short, that would be greatly appreciated. Representative Howell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kirchner, I'm actually going to follow up on Representative Baker's question. Is it where I understand that prior to, it used to be, it looked like many of these district engineers did a real good job, or some did a job of preserving their roadways, and others had an emphasis of expanding their roadways. And now it seems that my real question was when did the emphasis on preservation take hold? And I think you might have answered that with Map 21, if that was the emphasis that created that. But did you find now that some of those districts that had done a very good job of preservation now are kind of lacking the funds, or the funds aren't coming their way because their roadways aren't in that bad a shape, so now they can't get the expansion that they once needed?
Mr. Kirchner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That has been an issue that has been raised, certainly. It comes from a larger statewide focus, when you have a statewide planning approach where we say, okay, these are the biggest needs statewide, and we're going to direct money toward those biggest needs statewide, then certain areas of the state may end up getting more money than they had gotten before, because that's where a major project needs to get done. For example, around the time that we were doing this project, there was a major issue on the Blatnik Bridge in Duluth, which is a big bridge, and it cost a lot of money to fix. And so if District 1 had to put its bridge money toward that, that would have been it. but there are other bridges in District 1 as well that needed some work, and so District 1, you know, was going to get some extra money because that was where the problem had cropped up, was on a big bridge which cost a lot of money. So, but I think that you're right that there are, the central planning does mean that there are some instances where in the past local districts would have been able to do some extra things that they're now not able to do because the money is being directed toward where the needs are seen to be the greatest.
Representative Jaskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Kirchner. Mr. Kirchner, the TPIC group, it strikes me as I look at the composition of that group that it appears to have kind of a metro or regional lean to it. Did you notice any particular regional bias in either the composition of the group or the decision making?
Mr. Kirchner.
I wouldn't say so much within TPIC itself. With regard to corridors of commerce, we did see a slight piece of bias. Bias might not be the right word, but a slight piece of preference given to the Metro District there, in that in one of the years, I don't remember, I think it might have been 2014 or 2015, in one of the years, Metro District was simply allowed to pick its corridors of commerce projects, which the other districts weren't able to do. But I don't know where that decision came from. I don't know if that was a TPIC decision or not, but that was something that we thought was a little different in that. Overall, each year of corridors of commerce, there was a different selection process and somewhat different selection criteria being used each time. Again, we didn't feel it was a transparent process or a consistent process.
Thank you.
Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In your case, you can usually define how much work you can do in a year. You usually tell us we have staff for 6 studies or whatever it is. As I've read through some of the analysis and then recommendations, I know that in the last few years particularly, we've been scrutinizing FTEs pretty regularly. So there likely are not people sitting at some desk waiting for another assignment. So when I see something like MnDOT does not track the number, extent, or cost of locally led trunk highway projects, and your recommendation is MnDOT should do that to track local spending, the uneasiness I feel is that are we expecting the impossible, that we, as we do an analysis like this and a recommendation, do we think about it from the perspective of what can reasonably be expected as they reshape their work?
Mr. Kirchner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hausman. I don't see that as being a major difficulty for MnDOT to do, and the reason is all of these projects have to be approved by MnDOT anyway. MnDOT knows about all these projects. It's not something that they don't know about. And our suggestion in the report is that all they simply need to do is to require some additional reporting of the local entities when they come forward and they say, hey, we want to do this interchange project, well, then you need to provide us, you know, at the end of the project, say, with an accounting of how much money that you spent on it so that we can put that in the report to the legislature. I don't see that as being a major burden on either the districts or MnDOT to have some sort of basic reporting of the total amount of money.
Final question from Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Kirchner. I'm just noting here another federal program for transportation funding. They all kind of have special purposes. I mean, does the number of funding sources just further complicate this? And would we be better off to just, you know, want block grants from the federal government and sort of one selection process?
Mr. Kirchner.
I think I'm going to suggest that you ask MnDOT that question. I don't think I have as strong of an understanding of all of the different federal types of programs that are coming forward. I will give, to some extent, the same answer I gave earlier. That's not something that was raised to us as we were talking with people about the various types of things that went into project selection. But it is certainly the case that we heard from MnDOT districts that there are times when they when money becomes available in one way or another, and then there is an effort to kind of put together projects to chase the money, essentially. And so to the extent that there may be federal funds that are directed in particular ways, I would expect that to happen. But I don't remember that. I don't remember a particular emphasis on unusual federal sources of funding.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kirchner. Thank you for being with us. I assume that you are available to members if they have individual questions.
Absolutely.
At some time. Members, please feel free to reach out to the auditor's office if you have further questions. At this time, we're going to excuse you and bring up the Minnesota Department of Transportation. I'm afraid we've gone a little further into the time slot than I had hoped before we got to your presentation. So if you can abbreviate where appropriate, that would be greatly appreciated. We have just over 45 minutes left in our scheduled time. Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your presentation.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mark Dieske. I'm the Director of the Office of Transportation System Management at MnDOT. And I'm going to just report back on some of the progress that we've made at MnDOT in project selection since the audit report was done. Mr. Kirchner actually did give a pretty good summary of our selection process. I have just a couple of slides just to kind of summarize that, especially for our regular program, what we call the regular program or the standard project selection process, which is the way most of the money gets allocated. But we use a performance-based planning and programming process. So when we start the process, we look for places where there are needs, where there's deficiencies in the system, where performance isn't up to what we want it to be, where the condition of the assets isn't up to what we want it to be. And we put all that information together to identify our needs. The second part of that process then is looking at what dollars we have to invest. This is the part that comes out of our long-range 20-year plan, where we determine which investments are most important to the people of Minnesota, to the condition of the infrastructure, and so on. And the end result of that process is we come out with some investment directions, some investment priorities that looks like this pie chart that was also in the previous presentation in terms of percentages. This is direction that we give to ourselves and to our districts on what kinds of projects they should choose. Each one of those pies in the pie chart has a certain outcome associated with it, and those are the outcomes then that we try to achieve with our program. Then after that, again, the analysis takes place in both the central office and the districts. They look at those needs, they look at those investment priorities, and they put those together and they coalesce into projects. The districts and the offices, specialty offices and central office kind of collaborate together on choosing which projects should be chosen from amongst the different projects that perhaps could be chosen. So in the end, we come up with a program of projects. Now, in this whole process, there is some public involvement. It's a little different than the public involvement that happens in the planning process or even at the project development process. At project selection, most of the public involvement happens at the district level, which some of you even pointed out in your questions before. At the district level, they will typically work with their area transportation partnerships, their regional development commissions, and their metropolitan planning organizations to help decide what the regionally important projects are. Districts will often communicate with their regional stakeholders, the public, city engineers, county engineers, the governments, and any other parties that are interested in the program. Centrally, one thing that we do is we do publish the draft STIP every year before we put it out, so there's a formal publication of it in the state register. We also publish our Capital Highway Improvement Plan, which is our 10-year work plan. Our program is 4 years long, so projects are selected out in year four. Projects from year five to year 10 are just planned, so those planned projects are available for many years before they are coming up for selection in the program, so there's lots of opportunity for people to respond to what we have coming up. So with that, I'll just focus then on what we have done since the audit report was completed. These were the six recommendations. Some things that we did right away to change our processes. One thing that we did was we immediately beefed up our documentation process. I think you heard that sometimes the decisions we made were not questioned. They were good decisions, but we didn't really have the documentation to support that. So that's something that we have immediately taken into account and worked to improve that. We have also made sure that any new program criteria, any new programs that we have, they're specific, they're data-driven, they're well-documented, and that we make those available to the places that need to know what we're picking. So one program that has come up since the audit was the Fast Lane program, which was the federal program out of the FAST Act for major freight projects. We have used a formula process for that. And another thing that we've done is we accelerated the development of our capital improvement program. This is something new. In the past years, I would come and say our program is in the STIP, the Statewide Transportation Improvement Program, and I'd need two hands to hold it up because it's kind of thick. This is meant to be a thinner, easier-to-read version of that. It will tell you if you want to know what's MnDOT doing in the next 4 years, it's a place where you can go and just quickly find out which projects those are. So we're hoping that this is something that will make understanding our program a lot more transparent to people who are not interested in reading the whole STIP. So with that, then, we'll start with recommendation number one. The first recommendation was that MnDOT should take steps to improve the transparency of its standard project selection process. So as Mr. Kirshner pointed out, MnDOT actually has several selection processes. We do have documentation on a lot of them, but we've inventoried all of them that we have. Those that didn't have documentation, we've written some. We're collecting all that information together right now to put onto a website, and we will be enhancing some of that information to get at more of the questions that the public may have about how projects are picked, but also why some projects aren't picked, so that there is a place where they can go and see that. We also have, when we completed our 20-year Minnesota State Highway Investment Plan, that's the other document I brought here for visual aids. This is also brand new, came out just 2-3 weeks ago. So while we were working on that, we added additional explanation in that document on how MnDOT selects projects. So if you would go to Appendix E in that document, you would find an expanded explanation of project selection over past versions of the long-range plan. We're also developing a concept for a public web page that will make all of this information, tie it all together in one place. So anybody who's interested, any member of the public or a transportation stakeholder will be able to go there and find out all the programs, how much money is in them, how projects get picked, where they are in the program or not in the program. So we'll make all that information available. We were talking about TPIC, the Transportation Program Investment Committee. We have updated the charter of that group so that there's good documentation about what their authority is to change the program, how they make exceptions when exceptions are necessary, so that's all documented. We continue to make improvements to our 10-year Capital Highway Investment Plan. That's the one that explains what's coming up in the next 10 years, using that as a tool for communication with the public so that they can see what's coming way in advance of projects being selected for the program. later this spring and the rest of this summer, our emphasis is going to be on going around to our districts and our specialty offices and gathering from them their best practices for engaging the public and their stakeholders in information about project selection. We heard that, you know, some districts do that very well. Other districts use different methods. What we would like to do is go around and kind of collect all those methods, because we do know that in some places the local agencies were very satisfied with the amount of information they had, and in other places apparently they weren't. So we'd like to share all those best practices within MnDOT and make those available so everybody can choose the ones that would be most effective in their area. Okay, recommendation number two was about corridors of commerce and about the scoring criteria and using them consistently. So what we have done over the past 3-4 months is that we have gone through and we've developed criteria definitions and some project scoring methodology for all the statutory, all seven of them, all statutory required criteria, and any ones that MnDOT might consider adding to that. So we've got that done. The next task for us in that over the next 2 to 3 months will be to load some live project data into that. We'll take the list of projects the public gave us at the last solicitation. We'll get the data that it needs to run the formula. We'll plug all that information in, and we'll work on the weighting factors and reporting of that information and make that all available to the public. When it's done, we'll put that all out on the public website. Second recommendation, also about corridors of commerce, was reporting to the public how we are using the ranking criteria and determining which projects are eligible, and that we report that to the legislature annually. So there already is an annual report required of corridors of commerce, so we will include that information in that report. But beyond that, we will make sure that that information is on the website before we do another solicitation, so the public can see that before they turn in their ideas, so that they have an idea of what we're looking for, what might score highly, and so they will know that in advance. Recommendation number four was about tracking local government spending on trunk highways. Most of it is tracked, we have found, but definitely there is some that is not. We're in the process right now of trying to determine which of that would be efficient for us to try to collect. Some of it I think we can, probably more than we have. Some of it won't be. So we will complete that determination and report then on what the local investment is in the Trunk Highway system. Recommendation number five was about limiting programs that require projects to begin within 3 years. This was the project readiness factor recommendation. So this is something that may take both of us to work together. This is a suggestion that I have for how we might be able to approach this when it's possible, and it's not always possible because sometimes there's funding restrictions, sometimes there's very limited program criteria, but when it is possible, what we would like to do with new money, when we have that flexibility, is to use it in the most efficient way that we can. And usually the most efficient way to deliver projects quickly is to deliver projects that we've already started working on. So what we're suggesting is that we have created a list of flexible projects. Flexible letting date is what that means. Projects that are out in the second year or the third year that we put a little extra effort into to get them ready so that if money came up, we could pull those up. Now, the good thing about that is these were projects that we were going to do already anyway. And when you pull those projects forward, it creates an opening in that outer year to do other projects that maybe weren't quite ready, but we could get ready if we had just a little more time. So that's kind of what we would like to do is when the law allows and the situation is appropriate for that, to kind of use that as our method of efficiently using new funds. And then, of course, documenting which projects we advanced, which projects got added, so that we can answer those questions about that $134 million that you got, what did you do with it? So we would be able to do that. Regarding readiness, the concept of readiness, I think if we tie it, as Mr. Kirchner said, directly to something like cost, maybe safety, maybe potential lives saved, that kind of thing, I think that's not a difficult thing to do. Probably just in our minds that was understood when we made something ready a higher priority, but we certainly would have no problem tying that down to other factors like savings and costs, avoided inflation, reduced user costs, so those kind of things. So we'll put together a little paper and recommendation on that. And then the last recommendation was to develop a transparent long-term planning prioritization process for expansion projects that would get funded through one of the other alternative processes like Corridors of Commerce, like the Federal Tiger or Fastlane, or any other program that might come along that would have funds set aside for expansion. So some things that we have done since the audit was done was, again, the Minnesota State Highway Investment Plan, our 20-year long-range plan. When they were out doing public input for our constrained 20-year investments, they also asked them, what would you like us to do with new money? If we got new money and we were to do expansion, how would you have us prioritize those projects? So what they heard back from the public was that they would like us to consider safety, mobility, reliability, freight benefits, and multimodal benefits. So we've gathered that public input. The next step for us here now would be to go through kind of a more formal planning process, using that as information along with other information that we have on performance measures, and develop a method of planning for and scoring and ranking and listing those projects for those competitive programs. And when we get that done, that also would be something that we would post on the webpage. So all of this, all of these actions, it is my plan that these would all be substantially complete and ready to use in our next programming cycle that starts in November of 2017 for the 2019 to 2022 program. So that is my abbreviated presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Giesecke. I have five questions, quick questions for you, and then we're going to move on to the second part of the presentation. Representative Bernardi.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question that I have a couple here. One is, how do you factor in remaining service life into your project selection? That would seem to me it would be a major criteria to know, not just about smoothness and surface, but what's how they're crumbling underneath. That's my first question.
Mr. Giesecke.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, remaining service life is a kind of a new concept that we're still kind of studying to see exactly what it tells us, what level we should be shooting for, how you would pick projects that way. So at the moment, we do use surface condition as our performance target, but we are in the process of evaluating when and how to use remaining service life as possibly a more descriptive measure of when a project needs work. So that's where we're at right now.
Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then the other question I have is regarding environmental justice, and I'll wrap in the environment in it. So environmental justice, I was expecting to hear something about how you're incorporating that in your program, and I'm not sure if that was in at the beginning of them and how you're going to incorporate that. Could you just explain that to me? And then the other one, you had mentioned the four criteria that people had said in SHIP for expansion, the public involvement for expansion. I do recall, and it might not have been for expansion, it might have been for the whole program, that environment was the number one concern of the public. Can you share with me how that factors into this as well?
Director Giesecke.
So the first question about environmental justice, there were a few recommendations that were not like specifically called out, but were recommendations in the report that I didn't include. And one of them was that environmental justice or equity considerations have been considered at the planning stage. They also have been used at the project development stage. They haven't been used as much in the project selection stage. So we recognize that. It is something, though, that in our last planning process we identified as a goal that we would like to explore and figure out how exactly we would do that and how that might change the selection process that we have.
Representative Howell.
And the second question was?
Mr. Chair, he's finishing that question that I asked.
All right.
Thank you.
And I'm sorry, Director, you didn't need the second question again.
Well, about thank you, Mr. Chair, the environment.
Oh.
That was the public's number one response or concern.
Right.
And so in the planning process, the public was asked which of the future trends that they were most concerned about in environment was one of those future trends. So that will be something that over the next 4 years now we will have planning with groups come together and try to look at how the environmental concerns that we have might affect future project selection and programming.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Giese. My question relates to, you, back on slide 10, you made the you stated that I guess the concern was you limit the programs or agreements that require an initiation of the trunk highway project less than 3 years, and you made the statement as far as where the law allows. Can you give me an example of where the law doesn't allow us to do that, and specifically what state law prevents us from doing that, so we may be able to influence that and remove that barrier from doing the right thing?
Director Giesecke.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, federal programs are a little more notorious for saying that they want a project that you can deliver maybe in the next calendar year. That's pretty difficult to do with a project that you haven't done any work on yet. For state law, I would say probably it's the biggest restriction is just the biennial budget. If it's something that needs to be delivered in the biennium, that means that it has to be a project that we can make ready in 2 years or less.
Representative Howe.
Thank you for the follow-up, Mr. Chair. So there are restrictions that say that you have to deliver a project in the biennium. I guess I wasn't aware that we had that.
Director Giesecke.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it depends on how it's appropriated to us. If it's some programs are available till spent. Bond programs are available usually for 4 years. If it's just an added appropriation into our biennial budget, then it follows the biennial budget process.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Giesecke, my question relates to return on investment as a criteria in the corridors of commerce, and I do note that the only two expansion projects in the long list on page 57 that showed a high return on investment were those in the metropolitan area. The many rural projects were determined to be low. And my question, therefore, is how do you apply the complexity of the variance in the economics of the metropolitan area versus, you know, a vibrant metro area versus regional centers like Wilmer or New Ulm? How do you apply return on investment, and how do you account for the inherent differences between those sorts of locations?
Director Giesecke.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the return on investment calculation that we use considers more direct kind of costs like reduction in crashes, savings in travel time because of reduction of congestion, maybe reduced travel length. It does not include things like potential economic development. So when we use our return on investment calculation, it will favor something that has a high traffic volume.
A follow-up, Representative Johnson.
Yeah, thank you. Then, again, given inherently there's more traffic in the Twin Cities than there is in New Ulm, are you looking at any alternatives to move beyond the predominance of the question of congestion in determining funding for the corridors of commerce, which obviously has its purpose is to connect regional centers?
Director Giesecke.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and we know that it's difficult for those kinds of projects to compete head-on against each other. A couple of ways we have dealt with that is one was to have kind of an enforced regional distribution so that those projects don't compete head-to-head against each other, but head-to-head against more similar kinds of projects. And use of the other factors that are not return on investment would be the other way.
A final question from Lead Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Giesecke, I was very encouraged by your recommendation number 2 related to corridors of commerce on page 7 of your presentation. It seemed like you were getting at some of those criteria questions I had asked Mr. Kirshner. Are you, when you look at these 7 criteria, as part of your formula weighting factors, are you ranking some criteria ahead of others?
Director Kirshner.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we haven't looked really at ranking the factors yet, but some of the factors, I would say, are going to provide more differentiation than others. So some of them for example, efficiency of movement of freight or connections to regional trade centers. Because the program's limited to the interregional corridor system, pretty much every interregional corridor provides a link to a trade center. So that factor won't create as much difference as, say, a return on investment would. So some of them are going to be more meaningful than others, but we haven't really prioritized them or weighted them yet.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Very quick.
Follow-up, President Horn.
And then on number C, on recommendation number two, when will you be producing the scored and ranked list of eligible projects?
Director Giesecke.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm hoping that this is something that we would get done before we might need to use it again for another round of the program. So hopefully in the next 2-3 months, I'm expecting we'll have something ready to test. Yeah.
Excellent. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Director Giesecke, for your presentation. I'm sure you're available for further questions if members have them. We'll move on to the second part of the DOT's presentation. If you please come forward. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your presentation.
Hi, I'm Peter Davich. I'm MnDOT's Design Build Program Manager. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I was asked to come in and talk about three topics today. Just to jump right into it, knowing time's limited. We are the delivery methods that MnDOT uses to deliver our roadway projects within the programs that have been discussed here.
Mr. Davich, could I just have you move over a little bit towards the microphone? I think we could hear you just a little better. Thank you.
Let's try that. Any better?
Yeah.
Okay. So the three topics I had were the delivery methods that MnDOT utilizes to deliver the projects that we've been talking about in these programs, how we select which of those delivery methods we utilize for the different projects, and a few factors related to best value, low bid, how those are selected for various projects, and how we utilize them, how we run those programs. I'll jump right into it here. I'll just point out that on the first draft of this presentation, I used the word criterion twice, so I'm glad I took those up.
That's fun. But,
at a high level, a delivery method is a method by which we determine who is constructing a project and who is completing the design on a project, as well as who is taking the various risks associated with the project. There's many risks on roadway project. A few of the common ones are things like the soil conditions, whether it's good sands, muck, or something we don't know yet. Constructability, whether the design can be constructed as planned or whether we're going to need changes. Utilities, third-party impacts of many sorts, whether we're going to have noise impacts that might bother locals, wetland impacts, things like that. And design performance, right, regarding whether the design of the project is going to function as intended. So delivered method is helps to sort out who's taking those risks, who's completing design, who's completing construction. And the three methods we have are the traditional method, which we call design, bid, build, and the two alternative methods, which we call design, build, and construction manager, general contractor. MnDOT is one of few states to use all three of those. There are a few others, such as D3 or some hybrid methods that we do not use at this time. Those are our three. I'll explain what those are in the next slide. Just briefly, knowing time's limited, here's the brief history of the program when the legislation was passed. Design Build has been around since 1996. Our modern legislation passed in 2001 and has been used since that time. MnDOT received Design Bid Build Best Value Authority in 2007. I mentioned that in a slide or two. And CMGC had the legislation passed in 2013. Since that time, we've let 41 projects. You can see the breakdown there. I'll just point out that there are usually 4 to 5 alternative delivery projects per year. That's out of programs totaling about 230 projects. So by number, it's a very small percentage, although they do tend to be large projects and make up maybe 15 or 20% of the program by cost. There's a couple limits in the statute. CMGC is limited to 10 total projects, as you probably know. We've used 3 of the 7 thus far. And design build is limited to 10% of MnDOT's annual program. Again, given that there are 230 projects, we would need to have 23 design build projects before that was an issue, and we're not close to that at this time. To explain what the methods are a little bit, that's the next three slides. The traditional method is design, bid, build. At a high level, it's the one that most people understand. MnDOT's ORR consultant completes the design for a project. The roadway projects, MnDOT's typically expert at these sorts of projects. So we complete the design, we specify some methods for construction, and we put the project out for bid. The contractor who can do it for the lowest cost is awarded the job, and they move forward. Design, bid, build is used to deliver 98% of MnDOT's projects, and rightfully so. It's quite often the right fit. On non-complicated projects, cost is minimized. There are a few other issues, and MnDOT typically knows how to design and recommend construction on these projects, so it's a good fit. MnDOT maintains full control of the design, and the project partners are typically familiar with the method, so it works well. Some of the drawbacks, if it is perhaps a more complicated project, contractors can often add value to the process by suggesting particular cost efficiencies, be they related to the crews available in the work, styles of equipment that might be utilized on a project, or some other factors. The more complicated the project is, typically the more those enhance the cost efficiency of the project. So on those projects, design, bid, build might be missing out by missing something. The award, again, it's usually low bid, does not consider factors other than cost. So if there are other goals for the project, design, bid, build usually does not consider those. And MnDOT does hold almost all of the risks on the project in design, bid, build. Not all, but for most cases, if there are poor soils discovered or the design isn't constructible or things like that, change orders are necessary. And so for design, bid, build projects, we need to enter a change order if something like that changes in the field, as opposed to some of the alternative methods where that risk is shared and not always held by MnDOT. So briefly, the note at the bottom, the one exception to this is the upcoming 35W Lake Street project. That is a design, bid, build project, but it will have a best value letting. It's the first time we've used that 2070 authority in that particular way, but that project has many goals that go beyond cost. Certainly cost is the most important, but the award is also going to factor in some things such as risks, local impact, workforce, and other factors. Second method is design-build. For this method, MnDOT completes only as much preliminary design as we have to in order to commit to the scope of the project for the purposes of agreements with locals and cities, regulatory agencies, what have you. And then we stop and we hold a procurement, and we ask design build teams to come in and propose projects to us which have which meet the specifications we have for the job. We might tell them we want a road that goes from A to B, we want to keep two lanes open at all time, a few other things relating to the performance like that. So notably, we don't tell them how to do it. Then the contractors return proposals to us, we review those, and those that have the best combination of technical quality and low cost are those we want to award the project to in the best value manner. Going through the benefits and drawbacks on complicated projects, inverse of what I said for bid build, there's cost efficiencies in regards to asking the contractor how to construct some of these very complicated projects with the techniques that they might have. Similarly, from the design side of the world, when the design becomes more complicated, there's more value in having a number of different designers look at it and kind of have different designs competing in regards to efficiencies and value engineering. It's particularly valuable if we have a type of project that's new to MnDOT. So maybe it's a slope that's failing 80 feet deep in Crookston, or rural intersection conflict warning systems, which have electrical designs somewhat new to MnDOT. That design competition is very valuable in those cases. There's more options for risk transfer. Again, the contractor takes on more constructability, quantity risks. Project acceleration, as mentioned, sometimes money comes in and does need to be spent by the end of the biennium, or there's other reasons that construction needs to be completed quickly so as to eliminate traffic impacts. Design build typically has some more options there. First, the contractor is participating in the design very directly. And second, because the project's let at 0 to 30% of plan stage, it gets out the door more quickly and starts getting constructed in the field. Alternative technical concepts, I'll just mention briefly. We do have one provision in design build contracts where we say these are the goals of the project, and these are our specifications for how we'd like you to do it. If you, as the contractor, notice that you think you could meet our goals better by doing something slightly different than what we have in the contract, submit to us what we call an alternative technical concept. We will judge whether we believe the design is equal or better to what we currently have, and if so, we'll allow the contractor to use that concept. quite often at a cost efficiency, sometimes an increase in design quality. Over the life of the design-build program, I believe we've accepted around 400 ATCs for an approximate savings in the ballpark of $48 million. Drawbacks on non-complicated projects, there are some overhead costs. The contractor does take on more management costs related to the designer, some of the environmental oversight. And some third-party risks, particularly those related to continuing design interaction, are difficult to pass to a contractor. For example, if we know a contract is going to have continuing input from a historic agency or a local group interested in aesthetics, it's difficult for a contractor to bid on a project knowing that those risks might be, they're not certain that they're going to have to bid after that interaction is complete. So some of those projects are better fit for other methods. And there are some staffing changes required for oversight. Construction manager, general contractor, again, we typically call that CMGC. It starts similarly to design build, but and the design is brought to 0 to 30% completion, but instead of hiring the contractor to complete the design, the contractor advises MnDOT to our consultant on how to complete the design. During that stage, the contractor's knowledge is incorporated in the design, and MnDOT maintains full control over the design, which helps mitigate some of those third-party risks related to design controls and things, as well as many others. But as this is going on, the MnDOT's estimators, the contractor's estimators, and two third-party estimators are discussing the cost of the project, and they are kind of validating the costs that each of them come up with. They're discussing the risks and kind of coming together until a final price can be agreed upon, and assuming it is, the contract is given to that CMGC contractor for the price that's validated. Other benefits not mentioned, early cost and schedule certainty. Because MnDOT's talking to the contractor earlier than usual, we know what the cost will be before the project is formally let, which may help fund the project more directly. And we, for schedule certainty, we can tell locals or those very interested in moving quickly what time frame things are going to be completed. Again, the 53 project in Virginia was mentioned, and that's the picture here. So for that project, there were very many third-party risks surrounding the project involving how that bridge is constructed and how quickly it's done. Virginia's water supply in it, all manner of factors which are risky moving forward. CMGC was a good pick to mitigate some of those with the contractor in discussion. Drawbacks are, again, related largely to resources. There's a lot of effort that goes into the estimating process to make sure that the prices are validated in a good manner, and it's somewhat resource-intensive to manage the design.
Just one moment. What's the picture of?
Go. The picture is of Highway 53, so that is the bridge being constructed over the mine pit.
I won the bet.
So, to get to how do we select one of these methods for a project, I know you can't read the flow charts here, but the point is we do have flow charts that guide us through a decision process to select these methods. Brief description of the process would be 4 to 5 years prior to letting a project. Myself, as a method manager, some of the program managers and the project managers look at the program, and we flag projects that are complex, have high risks, and otherwise have good factors for alternative delivery. We keep that candidate list and kind of watch those projects over time and share it with anybody who asks, let them know what projects might be coming up in the alternative delivery programs. The formal method was actually developed by Keith Molinar, who's a researcher at the University of Colorado. It's used by the Colorado DOT and some others. In short, ideally about 2 years prior to letting, once the scope of the project and the risks associated with the project are known, we get together and have a managed discussion, which is focused on risk, cost, schedule, these things I've been discussing, in the context of the delivery methods. We go through and make strength, weakness notes in regards to whether, for example, design build can help with schedule in a particular case, or whether bid build can help with cost. After spending a day going through this with the core project team and the delivery experts, the group ideally recommends a method. If it's found that there's not enough information or there's something missing, we do note that, and we say, all right, we're going to need to reconvene this group at a later date once X or Y is known, whatever that factor may be. But if not, so the group recommends a method. It's passed to leadership. I should say MnDOT leadership. And if they approve it, the result is posted publicly. It can actually be viewed on our website in case anybody's curious why a particular project may have gone a particular way. To jump to the third topic, low bid versus best value, there are types of awards, i.e. it's who the project is awarded to at the end of the letting. Low bids, very intuitive, of course. Whoever bids the lowest cost for the project is awarded the job. The contractor's effect on other goals is not considered, and it's appropriate for projects with relatively low levels of complexity and risk, which is 95% of the time by my definition. Best value, obviously for projects with high complexity or risk, and cost is still by far the most important factor in a best value letting, but there are other things we consider as well. I guess slight tangent, we've had 26 best value lettings to date. Of those, actually the low bidder has been awarded the job 24 of those 26 times. So again, cost is still very strongly considered, but other factors are as well. And actually, in many of those cases, the successful team had the low bid and the highest technical score. A few examples, we often score the contractor's effect on completion speed, how quick a road is open, environmental impact, again, noise, wetlands, things like that. Design quality, whether the slope is stable, 80 feet deep, whether the electrical system works, maintainability, many other things. We've used a whole host of factors. Which might cause you to wonder, how do we determine those factors? We have a process. This is primarily what we do in design build. We develop some evaluation factors, scoring criteria. In short, we look at the project goals. We determine which the contractor can have an effect on. Then we have a discussion. All right, imagine the contractor does a very good job at meeting one of these goals. And imagine a different contractor did a very poor job at one of these goals. What is that worth to us in dollar terms? If there isn't really a difference, that's going to be a poor criterion. We aren't going to use it. If there is a difference, we note that, we document it, and we say, okay, we do see that this has real value to MnDOT or our users. We then go through a process. We have some white papers on this if interested. I won't kind of bore you with the details. But in short, we assign points to each criteria, and we say they're roughly worth one hundredth of the project cost, the way it's typically calculated. So if it's a $100 million project, a point is worth $1 million. If we think good performance at goal X is worth $3 million more than poor performance, we'd assign it 3 points. We do that for as many criteria as we see value in, and the rest of the points are basically not used and just go to more heavily weight the price, if that makes sense. Again, I know I'm going through that quick. There are documents to explain this in more detail if interested. But the project is ultimately awarded to the team who has the lowest number after dividing the price by the technical score. It's kind of the same as the low bidder wins, just has the technical score added in the calculation. The draft evaluation factors are typically posted online for the industry comments. Sometimes receive comments, sometimes not. And the final factors are approved by many members in management and the chief engineer. Last couple slides, how do we evaluate this? Once the teams return technical proposals to us, we identify a technical review committee. It has one member from the AGC, the Association of General Contractors, and four or more from MnDOT, who are experienced principal level engineers or higher. They are the ones who score the project. If the criteria require expert judgments in order to be able to evaluate, we have expert subcommittees as needed to advise them, and a legal subcommittee to advise on procurement level issues. In initiating that process, I or somebody in my position trains the technical review committee. We train them regarding the confidentiality needed. They can only value things that are specifically criteria and not factors that aren't related. Professionalism, many other things. After that training is complete, the teams are given their scoring packets along with the technical proposals, and they have them for 1 to 2 weeks. And the scoring sheets look like this. You can see the criteria on the left. They mark whether it's a strong strength or a large weakness. Then they make comments on those. Okay. For the next week or two, the scores make their comments on these sheets at home, basically. Then we convene. We have a 2 to 3 day meeting, so it's a rather long meeting to evaluate all these comments. The scores essentially go around the room, and they read off their comments and all the proposals. Consensus isn't required. They don't have to agree with each other. They often disagree, sometimes distinctly. But they do have to have enough of a conversation that everybody understands the comments the other proposers are making or the subcommittees. There's a process oversight committee that oversees this process. It'll be myself, a delivery method manager, perhaps a member of FHWA at times, or others. I go through the 2 to 3 days. At the end, each member creates their score for each criteria and ultimately for each proposer. They do this per the rules in the evaluation manual, which, again, I don't have time to get too deep into here. It's in a white paper if you'd like to see it. But basically, they make a number between 0 and 100. Each five score has their own scores. It's averaged into a total score for each proposer. And before it's posted, the chief engineer approves the results. And the spreadsheet like this is announced publicly on the letting date. So on the letting dates, we open up the technical scores. We announce them kind of publicly on a screen. The proposal prices are read off, and that's formula I said before, price divided by technical score is executed to get that final score. So you can see the lowest number there in orange is the one that would have been successful in this case and may move forward as the apparent best value proposer. It's a very formulaic process at that point. Finally, a note on transparency. In regards to what we put out about this process, both the criteria are put out prior to bid. After bid, we release the scoring forms. We actually release all the comments from all the review committee members. We put the technical proposals online, and we do have the member of the AGC who serves on the committee. I do believe we are relatively uniquely almost transparent on that. There are other states that release, most states release the scoring forms. Some other states release the comments, usually not as many as we do, and I don't believe there's any other state that actually has a member of the AGC on the scoring committee, so that's somewhat unique. But that's the end of what I had prepared. Questions?
Thank you for your presentation. I need you to remind me the pronunciation of your name.
Davich.
Davich, not yep. Davich, but Davich.
Davich, yes.
Thank you for that. I do have a question for Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your presentation. I am still kind of tracking the money and how we have a best value that is based primarily on the cost when the design isn't even done yet, meaning that there's always going to be variations. So because a contractor could bid low and then coming in with the design in order to accommodate his value or his proposal, it seems to me we're giving a little bit more authority to the contractor there instead of the best interest of our state as well. Are we getting different over project costs for projects like this compared to our low bid? Are we keeping them within the same parameters as well? I mean, I'm just trying to figure out how we can say price is a key factor when we don't even know what the price is going to be yet without the design.
Mr. Davich.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the price that the contractor gives us at award is a lump sum price that they are committed to for the duration of the project. So if something changes later on, like I said, sometimes there are change orders if MnDOT decides we want a different design for some reason, but the change orders on design build or other methods are typically lower than one would see in bid build. In relation to the design being complete, MnDOT, the design is not complete for MnDOT. The contractors do a significant amount of work with their design build teams to advance the design near letting, so they are fairly certain what they're going to build when they make their proposal. We're just choosing between the different proposals, and they execute it for a price that they commit to. Does that answer the question?
Just one.
Petersburg, a follow-up.
Just one brief follow-up. Yeah, I understand, okay, from what you're saying. So are we keeping them within the same, I think we all have a certain amount of overage or overrun that we can allow for a project to go. Are they the same with low bid versus this particular program?
Mr. Davich.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, actually they're typically lower. For bid build projects, change orders are typically on the order of 6 or 7% following letting. For the design build program, which I track, it's been 3 to 3.5%. In large part, that's because on bid build projects, MnDOT calculates quantities. They say, here's how many cubic yards of fill to anticipate on a job, things like that. In design build, that's the contractor's responsibility to calculate that. So if the number is off, they were the ones who completed the design, so they take responsibility for any differential there.
Representative Bernardi, if you got a new question or the same old one?
What's the same old one? Your new service day, Mr. Chair, or which one?
You decide, Representative
okay.
Bernardi.
Thank you. My question for you is when you do this type of bidding, and I'm guessing that you've done a lot of community engagement before you go out with some of these bids. I wanted to ask if that's accurate. And then when you do that community engagement to know what the community needs are and how to move forward, how do you transfer that knowledge and information to the designer and the builder? I've seen projects where there's been a disconnect, and the commissioner talked about one hand doesn't know what the other hand's doing. And so I wanted to find out, how do you try to mitigate that?
Mr. Davich.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that is a good question. It does vary by project to project. Most typically in design build, MnDOT does most of the community engagement up front. that's kind of that 0 to 30% design. We go through and make sure we know what our project partners are going to ask for in the project, such the design builder doesn't have to decide whether or not to honor. It's kind of out of the goodness of their heart after they commit to a price. So in most cases, if there is something like that, we're going to have the conversation with the locals up front and specify it in the contract and say, you must do this and this and this for the purposes of local. Keep two lanes open at all time, maintain the access to XYZ farm, things like that. If there are projects or issues that come up during construction, there are certainly MnDOT overseers on the job. Those issues go to them. If we want to ask for something that wasn't anticipated in the original specifications, there are still change orders for things like that, and we're still listening. But by and large, the community engagement occurs up front. Although it does sometimes, for unique things like the 35W bridge collapse, for example, that had design charrettes falling letting, there are exceptions.
Ms. Bernardi?
I'll talk with them after.
Well,
thank you.
Representative Runbeck has a final question.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Hieske. No.
Davich.
Can you just make a comment on the difference in the final quote, let's just say, that the materials makes? I mean, how are there a lot? Is there a broad range of choices in the materials that go into the road construction, and do those represent significant price differences?
Mr. Davich.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, typically, yes. Again, speaking primarily for design build, in design build we specify very few materials unless there's something we know we want for aesthetic or other reasons, maybe consistency along a corridor. By and large, the contractor gets to choose which materials to use so long as they follow our general spec book and their materials we might typically allow on those sorts of projects. We do not typically, however, specify which ones they must use. It's up to them to see which ones they can procure most inexpensively and fit in with the design that they are completing.
Follow up,
and so, Mr. Chair, that's for the design build, which is 10% of the total program, right, of projects?
Actually, it's about 2%. Per legislation, it can be no more than 10%, but typically it's about 2% by number.
Okay, so then maybe my question is about the traditional method that you typically use, so I'll have to ask that of someone else maybe.
That might be good, yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, members. Thank you, Mr. Davich, for your presentation. This meeting is adjourned.